This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Samuel Fromarts, a Washington, D.C.-based freelance business journalist whose work has appeared in Fortune, Inc., Business Week, The New York Times, and many other publications. Samuel has ties to the Northwest, and he worked on a tree planting co-op in Northeast Washington State just after graduating from Reed College. Samuel Fromarts is here today to tell us about his newly published book, Organic Inc., Natural Foods and How They Grew. Welcome, Samuel.
Hi, great to be here.
What led to your interest in organic food and your decision to write your book, Organic Inc.?
Well, I like to say I came to this subject through my stomach. I was an avid, and I still am an avid home cook. I cook for our family. I guess I got into organics in the mid-90s, and it was really from a quality point of view rather than nutrition or health concerns. I was just looking for high-quality fruits and vegetables. In my area in Washington, D.C., the prevalent organic and natural food retailer is Whole Foods. We don't have a lot of co-ops here, that kind of thing. So I found my way to Whole Foods and began buying a lot of organic produce and other organic goods. And I noticed the lines in the store getting longer, and I noticed the parking lot getting more full, and they actually began to offer valet parking in the parking lot. And so I began to wonder, you know, what's going on here? This segment is really growing. I'm buying it. I wanted to understand really my own motivations, but also, you know, the motivations of other consumers as well. So that began this journey, you know, what was this food, where did it come from, and why were so many of us buying it? Those were the initial questions I had.
What is the definition of organic?
Well, there's a couple ways to look at it. I think if you go back in history, the idea really started about a century ago, and it was an early reaction against the use of chemical fertilizers in Europe. And there were concerns then about what fertilizers were doing to the soil, about the nutritious quality of food, about the growing industrialization in the countryside. I mean, a lot of the issues that we hear about now, a lot of the current concerns that we have now about food, I mean, those were raised a century ago. And what the organic pioneer sort of envisioned was farming, but without chemicals. So, you know, farming in such a way that didn't that enriched the soil rather than denuded it, and they really saw it as a means of creating healthier, more nutritious food. So that's kind of the broad concept. What it's come to be now in our country and really around the world is a body of regulations that farmers and food processors have to follow to get that organic label. And those regulations run to about 500 pages.
What is known about to what extent and why consumers buy organic foods?
Well, the surveys primarily show, I mean, when they ask people, they mainly cite health and nutrition. Other factors that come up are also freshness, which I think is a larger issue of quality. And then lower down the list, actually, are things like concern about the environment, concerns about helping small farmers, that kind of thing. So I think people are more concerned about what they're putting in their bodies and what they want to avoid in milk, for example, getting milk from farms that don't use antibiotics or hormones in their milk production. That's a really key factor that's driving the organic milk market.
How much of our agriculture in the United States is organic agriculture?
Yeah, this surprised me, actually, because, I mean, organics has been in such the news lately, and, you know, we hear about it, and we see organic farmers at the farmers market, but organic farms are about 1% of all farms, and actually, certified organic farmland in our country is less than 1%. So the vast majority of farms are still conventional farms, and that's primarily because in the Midwest, they're farming things like corn and soybeans that rely on huge amount of chemicals, and in terms of acreage, that's the prevalent model. But what we do know is that organic is the only sector of agriculture that's growing, and interestingly, small farms are also growing as well, and many of those farmers tend to be organic.
How do the yields of organic crops compare to conventional crops?
Well, that's a tough question because it depends a lot on the crop and it depends on the farm, you know, on the particular soil. There was a long-running study in Switzerland that that's kind of the gold standard of studies. It went for, I think it was 22 years. And they found, averaging out a number of crops, that organic produced about 20% less. In grains, like wheat, for example, the deficit was lower. It was about half that, about 10%. And actually, university trials in the U.S. have found organic yields almost on par with conventional yields, with a deficit of 4 to 6% in grains like wheat or legumes like soybeans. So it's a mixed bag. In one chapter in my book, I focused on strawberries because they are really a chemically intensive crop. And I was, interested in what the organic methods were, and I spoke to several farmers who had done both conventional and organic production, and they said the yields were about 15 to 20% less. So you're producing less, but what you're getting, on the other end is a lower environmental impact, better health conditions for the workers who are working in the fields. And that's especially true of crops like strawberries and others that rely on neurotoxins, these fumigants, where the workers actually have to wear body suits and gas masks to work in the fields, which is pretty extreme, I think, if you're thinking about food production.
In your book, you speak about both the organic movement and the organic industry. How do these differ?
I think the organic, movement was really motivated by a set of ideals. And I wouldn't only include farmers in that. I think the early organic food companies, many of which still exist, the people who started those companies were motivated by ideals, too, in terms of creating, really an alternative food system, an alternative way of producing food, not only in the land, but in the food products themselves. And so it wasn't just fruits and vegetables, it was also organic tofu and soy milk and organic crackers. And you probably remember the organic blue corn chips, which was an early hit product in the organic food industry. So ideals motivated a lot of those people who began 2 to 3 decades ago. What's happened recently is Big Food has gotten into the sector, and they've recognized that organic is growing 20% a year, and that their main market, the conventional food market, is pretty much stagnant because the nation produces enough food. So if your main market is growing 2% a year and you see this other segment growing 20%, well, where are you going to put your investment money? It's going to be in the high growth area, which is why every major food company now has an organic arm at this point.
What fraction of the organic food sales in the U.S. are from large corporations compared to smaller companies right now?
I don't really know the answer to that question, but I do know, for example, the top two brands, organic food brands, are Horizon Organic and Silk Soy Milk. And those are both owned by Dean Foods, which is the largest dairy company in the nation. But, in the top five, you also have companies like Organic Valley, which is the largest organic farmers co-op in the nation. It has over 700 farmer members, and they own the company and, distribute their milk nationwide. And you have other companies like Amy's Kitchen, which is a family-owned company that's grown pretty dramatically. And it's one of the few that's managed, of the food companies, that's managed to remain independent, whereas a lot of other entrepreneurs sold out to larger companies, either because they had been in the business for so long and wanted to cash out, or because they felt joining up with a bigger company was really the only way to continue to grow the business with distribution and capital. So these factors have led a lot of entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, to sell their companies to bigger firms.
Could you speak about the challenges for the small organic businesses in retaining their values as they become larger?
Yeah, well, it's tough. One writer put it that there's mercenaries and there's missionaries. And I think, the smaller businesses and the smaller farmers are really the missionaries. They're the ones who are sort of spreading the word. And then you have other companies that are really getting into it for business reasons. And as a company becomes bigger, you're going to get more employees who maybe don't sign on precisely to the ideals that the founders had. And you're going to get, partnerships with other companies that are really looking at this as a business as opposed to to pursuing it for idealistic reasons. But here's the thing. I think there is a lot of concern about big business in there. But I think what's really important is to keep the organic regulations strong. So even a big company has to follow the rules. And you could argue that it might even be in the interest of a big company to keep the rules tight as a way to protect their market position. So you might not have ideals propelling all these companies, but if the outcome could be a good one, I don't really have a problem with that.
Could you give an example or two of your book of a small company that got bigger and what their specific challenges were?
A good example was Silk Soy Milk. I spoke to the founders, a guy named Steve Demos, who started in Boulder, Colorado, started making tofu in a storefront shop. His goal was always really to become big. And this is, I think, something that not everyone understands about the organic food industry, that a lot of the idealists early on wanted to grow their companies in part because that was a way of changing the food system and of increasing the demand for organic goods. What happened in his case is he was looking for a home run product, and it took him 20 years to find it. And basically it was refrigerated soy milk, which became Silk, which is now, as I mentioned, the number two brand in the organic marketplace. He was growing quickly and came close to bankruptcy twice. Now, we often think of bankruptcy as resulting from a failure of the business, but his brush with bankruptcy came because he was actually growing too fast. And so he was spending quicker than the money was coming in, and he was spending to expand. And so eventually he linked up with a dairy company, which in turn was bought by Dean Foods. And he thought that they were buying into his concept, that they were really buying into his ideals. And I think if you look at it, I think what they were really doing was buying into a growth business. What he hoped was that with Dean Foods' backing, he would really be able to work on a much larger stage in terms of bringing a more sort of enlightened values to the marketplace. And what ended up, I mean, he made a pile of money, but he also got fired by Dean Foods. So Silk now is run by a former executive from Gillette and owned by the biggest dairy company in the nation. Now, that said, is that product entirely compromised? Well, you know, they're still buying organic soybeans. Organic soy milk is the prevalent product in the market. Probably organic soy milk accounts for over 90% of all soy milk, whereas most organic products fight for 2% of the market. So if they keep producing to high standards, I think the outcome could be good. I think in terms of what he wanted, in terms of having corporate backing for kind of a more socially responsible business model, I think that didn't come to pass. Other companies that have sold out, like Stonyfield Farm, the yogurt company, I spoke to the founder of that company, Gary Hirschberg, who's still the CEO, and he's owned by a big French food company called Groupe Danone, but he has an unusual deal where he continues to control the board and feels like he can really pursue his mission in the way that he wants to at the same time that he's owned by this big food company. So it's kind of a mixed bag, I think.
Could you highlight what you think the benefits are of the larger companies that are selling organic compared to the smaller companies that may have stayed smaller and kept more completely to their original ideals?
Right. Well, I think this is the argument that's kind of split the organic sector and split a lot of the founders between those who wanted to remain small and kind of more pure and those who wanted to grow. You know, those who grew basically increased the demand for organic food. They brought more customers into the fold. For whatever reasons, they've convinced more consumers about the values of these foods. And that's meant that more acres could be converted to organic production. In the case of Silk, you know, there's probably thousands of acres of soybeans that are being grown to produce that product. And that means less chemical pesticides on the land, less herbicides, you know, cleaner water, better working conditions for farm workers. And a lot of these farm workers work on large-scale farms, you know, especially in California. So if we had a choice, would we rather have them be working on fields that are sprayed with pesticides or fields that are free of chemical pesticides. It can be a large-scale organic farm, but there can be some, there's definitely some benefits. I think the problem comes when you get conflicts between the bigger farms and smaller farms, and that's happening in some areas now where some small farmers or smaller farmers, not necessarily small ones, but sort of medium-sized farms, you know, feel pushed out by the efficiencies and low costs that a big farm can achieve. And it's kind of split the organic market between big and small.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Samuel Fromarts, author of the newly published book, Organic Inc., Natural Foods and How They Grew. Do you think it's possible, or would it be possible, to provide a large market for organic food without large companies?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think for that to happen, consumers would have to change the way they shop. Smaller scale farms primarily sell at, you know, farmers markets. They may sell at local grocery stores. But even, you know, I visited with some co-ops that, you know, for example, in the upper Midwest and other places that really make an effort to source from smaller farms. But they can't always do it, and they have to rely on some produce coming from big producers in California. And those producers can provide a high-quality product consistently. So I think it's tough. I think it's really hard for most consumers to shift their buying patterns dramatically in such a way that, you know, the majority of them are, say, going to be buying direct from a farmer at the farmers markets. And what I see happening, I think the reality, even for, you know, more conscious consumers or enlightened consumers or people who know about these issues, you'll still shop at the supermarket, but you'll also shop at the farmer's market. And I think that's kind of the reality of the marketplace. And even though I think local foods will grow and there'll be a continued really healthy market for smaller farms, it's just hard for me to see that model completely replacing the predominant one in our society. I mean, you got to remember, even organic foods and big organic, okay, like big California farms, that's only 2% of the food supply. So 98% of the food supply is still coming from conventional farming. So by and large, consumers out there are buying, you know, conventional foods, and maybe they're dabbling in organics, and they're dabbling at local foods, and there's obviously a core number of consumers who are really trying to buy local and are really trying to buy organic, but they're far from the majority.
Could you now speak about the National Organic Standards and why they were developed?
That's kind of interesting, because there's been an argument recently that these standards have basically meant that big companies could get into the business, and we kind of forget or are ignorant of why these standards came to be. And initially, there were voluntary standards by farmer organizations that just felt that people should farm in a certain way to a bare, you know, to a minimum of standards. One person recently told me that the one of the original body of standards in California was what could fit on one page. Now it's a much bigger body of regulations governing you know, everything from livestock farms and dairy farms to poultry producers and, you know, produce farms. But the main motivation for regulations was twofold. One was to prevent fraud, because there were cases in the 80s and 90s where conventional producers were selling their product as organic, even though it was conventional. And this was really irking organic producers who were doing it right, because here were these guys who were selling a fraudulent product, getting a higher price, and there was nothing to prevent them from doing that. There were some states that had laws, but many states didn't, and there was no national sanctions against that. And then secondly, there were producers who wanted to be able to sell their crops state to state, and so they wanted a consistent body of regulations. For example, in the early 90s, California had a one-year transition for an organic farm, which meant that if you farmed organically for 1 year, after that 1 year, you could sell your crop as organic. You know, on the East Coast, there was a three-year transition. So the question was, you know, if you shipped organic fruit from California to the Northeast, would it be organic in California, but it wouldn't be organic in Massachusetts? So there was really a need, especially with things like grains that aren't consumed where they're grown, to get some sort of level playing field for everybody. And so that was really the push behind getting organic law passed in 1990 and then instituting the regulations that took effect in 2002. But there was always a body of farmers and people in the movement who really didn't want government involvement. There's a strong libertarian streak in the organic movement of trying to create a separate food system, you know, that's outside of corporations, that doesn't rely on government. And these people really felt that that trying to get a federal regulation would undermine the whole idea of organic. And a lot of farmers at that point left because they just felt organic wasn't going in the direction they wanted.
What are the benefits and downsides of organic certification for the individual or small farmer?
Well, the only benefit for a small farmer is if they want to sell in the wholesale market, or to a consumer who's really looking for the organic label. Let me elaborate on this. In a farmer's market, for example, there's a USDA survey. About half of all farmers that farm organically get certification. So that means the other half use the methods but don't want to bother with certification. And they probably feel they don't need to, because if they're selling direct to their customer, either through a farmer's market or a subscription scheme like a community-supported agriculture where the customer pays up front for a whole season of vegetables, you know, the customer has a relationship with that farmer. He can ask about the practices and find out about the farm or even visit the farm. And so in that case, I don't think the farmer really needs to get certified. Where they do need it is if they want to sell in a market where they might not have direct contact with the customer. And in that case, a mother with kids who is really looking for that organic label because she doesn't want, you know, she wants to reduce the pesticides that her kids are consuming, there's nothing to assure her, you know, that the food's organic without the label. So the farmer needs to get certified in order to participate in that market. And, you know, I've seen that in my own area here in Washington, D.C. There's a farmers co-op of about 22 small farms in Pennsylvania, many of them Amish farms. And some of them, you know, don't want to make the trek to the farmer's market because it's too far. Or in the case of the Amish farmers, you know, they can't drive. And so they rely on the co-op to sell their food. And the co-op in turn sells to restaurants and food co-ops and supermarkets in the Washington region. And in order to get its price and to get the organic price, it needs organic certification. So the co-op has to be certified, the farms have to be certified, and you know, and that's what underpins the whole market. And so for those farmers, organic certification really works. You know, many of them are small scale. So I think it's more a function of the market channel that you're selling to and the way you're selling than anything else. You know, that's the determinant of organic certification.
What do you think is needed to make organic food the standard in our society rather than the exception?
Lower prices. That seems to be the main hindrance for mainstream consumers buying the food. They're not as knowledgeable about the sort of the wider benefits of organic food and aren't really aware of the prices that they're paying for conventional food outside of the checkout counter. And what I mean by that is they'll see, you know, a conventional food next to organic and they'll buy the conventional because it's cheaper. But what they don't realize is their tax dollars are going to farm subsidies, that there's cost in environmental pollution and groundwater pollution that they don't necessarily understand. And so there are costs to the conventional food, but they're just looking at the price, you know, at the supermarket. And what a lot of market studies have shown is that price is a hindrance to mainstream consumers. So we're kind of at a funny place, because if the price comes down, it could potentially hurt smaller growers whose costs are higher. You know, that said, there might be a segment of consumers, which I think there are, that will support paying more in order to keep their small farms in business and to buy a higher quality product, which these small farms provide. Realistically, I don't think agriculture is going to entirely change to organic. I think what's happening is that some organic practices are migrating to the conventional sector, And I think it's hopeful that in some cases pesticide usage is going down or farmers are getting more judicious about its use. I think, though, unless prices come down or if people all of a sudden become more fearful, really, of pesticides on their food, it's hard to see organic being more than an alternative, which is what it is. You know, maybe it's 2% of the food supply now. Maybe it could get to 20%. I'm hopeful that could happen. But, you know, even getting there is going to be a tough slog.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
You know, there's a lot of books out there that will tell you what to eat, and that's not my book. Nowhere in the book do I say you should eat organic food. What I try and do is really show the way food is produced. The more consumers know, the more informed their choices can be. In a lot of these issues, the choices are complicated. Should you buy local foods that support a small farmer that may use pesticides, or should you buy, you know, organic food from a big farm that may have operations in Chile? These are tough questions, and I don't think there are any absolute answers. I think the best we can do as consumers is really to know more about our food. So much about our food system is hidden, and actually it's hidden from reporters as well. It's very difficult to report on some of these issues. I think the more we know, the more we can make better choices. And as our choices change, I think the food system will change as well, because one thing businesses do is they respond to consumers. And I think the greatest evidence of that is the organic food market itself, which is changing the way some food companies do business and the way they support the sector. A lot of them really fought organic for a long time, and now they all have organic divisions. I think that says a lot.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message I'd like to leave listeners with is know your food. Don't take anything for granted. Learn as much as you can. Don't believe just what somebody tells you. I think it's really valuable to just spend time learning about these issues and then making informed choices.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Well, Diane, thank you. It was great to talk with you.
We have just been speaking with Samuel Fromarts, author of the book Organic Inc., Natural Foods and How They Grew, published in 2006 by Harcourt Books. For more information, check on the web at www.organicincbook.com. Again, that's organicincbook.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.